This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to discuss the legislative session, but first, jury selection's been going on all this week in the case of Noor Salman. Now, she's been charged with aiding and abetting her husband, Omar Mateen, in the Pulse shooting and obstruction of justice. 90.7's Brendan Byrne has been at jury selection this week and joins us now. Brendan, what's that process been like?
Well, U.S. District Judge Paul Byron's interviewing about 18 jurors a day, one at a time. He wants about 50 or 60 potential jurors in a pool, and then he'll pick the final 12 jurors and 6 alternates. These potential jurors filled out a questionnaire last year. Now he's really drilling down on some of the answers. He's asking them about how much media coverage they've consumed, their feelings on Islam, and if they knew anyone in the recent Parkland shooting.
Now, one of the questions, Brendan, that the judge asked was whether they've been a victim of a terrorist attack. Why did the judge ask that question?
Well, if you recall, Omar Mateen pledged his allegiance to ISIS in one of the 911 calls to negotiators during the Pulse shooting. So the government's case against Salman alleges that she aided and abetted her husband by offering material support to a terrorist organization. So the government needs to prove that during trial. Also, Noor Salman is Muslim, so the judge has been asking potential jurors if they know any Muslims, their feelings on Islam, and whether or not they feel the government treats immigrants from Muslim-majority countries unfairly. Here's Stetson Law professor Charlie Rose explaining why that's important.
The court is trying to identify bias against Muslim immigrants based either upon a perception about how the United States government treats them or whether the war on terror has created an unfair treatment of Muslims within the United States. What they're trying to do is to identify for both the government and for the defense those jurors who have a perception on this issue that might prevent them from deciding the case impartially based upon the evidence.
Now, it should be noted that both Omar Mateen and Noor Salman were born in the U.S. Salman is a U.S. citizen. Some jurors have been dismissed because of their responses to these questions. One potential juror felt the rise in violence in this country was from immigrants from Muslim-majority countries. Another felt Islam condoned violence and fear. And another dismissed juror said it would be difficult to ignore the news reports he had seen of Muslim extremists.
Now, Brendan, you reported yesterday another juror was dismissed for saying that they thought the Pulse gunman targeted the LGBTQ community.
Yeah, that's right. Juror number 211 said she had a close family member that identified as someone in the LGBT community and that she couldn't remain impartial if seated on the jury. Now, the judge said prosecutors aren't planning on making that argument that he targeted the LGBT community. Instead, he was motivated by terrorism. In fact, the defense filed a motion this week arguing that case. It says Mateen scouted other targets before going to Pulse, including Disney Springs, another downtown bar. Regardless, the judge dismissed the juror.
All right, so what's next in this process?
Well, like I said, jury selection will continue today until the judge has about 50 or 60 potential jurors in the pool. There's about 49 right now. That should continue today and possibly into Monday. Once the final jury is set, opening arguments will begin. That's looking like sometime next week, and the trial will last about 3 weeks.
90.7's Brendan Byrne has been following the trial of Noor Salman, the widow of the Pulse gunman. Thank you so much, Brendan.
Anytime.
Well, joining me in the studio now is former state lawmaker and Democratic analyst Dick Batchelor. Thanks for being here, Dick.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also joined by Chris Carmody, shareholder with Gray Robinson and Republican political analyst. He joins us from Tallahassee. Chris, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And you can join the conversation too. We're at 1-866-338-5252. We're over on Twitter at WMFE Orlando talking about the legislative session. Does school safety legislation go far enough to protect students? Are you happy to see more money for things like bright futures? And what about the environment? Is $100 million enough for Florida forever? Forever Florida, rather. First, though, Dick, I wanted to check in with you. There's been a couple of kind of last-minute changes, things that have come up again that lawmakers have discussed. One of them is a bill around human trafficking. This is kind of seesawed one way and then the other. What's the latest in this bill?
It has. This bill would actually have passed set some liability for hotel lodging establishments if they knowingly allow human trafficking. It was opposed by the lodging industry, hotel lodging industry. However, they got with the advocates on human trafficking issues, and they worked it out with the amendments that passed two House committees unanimously. Everybody thought it was going to be moving in the Senate. The Senate sponsor, Senator Book, withdrew it from consideration by the committee. A lot of pressure came on from around the state, and now as of yesterday, and Chris is there, he might have more details, but as of yesterday, Senator Book has actually got the Senate to waive the rules and put this bill back in play. So It's back in play for the next, well, today is the last day.
Mm-hmm. Chris, are you hearing anything about that particular bill?
Yes, I was actually up in the gallery when that bill was pulled from committee, and it requires a two-thirds vote. And Senator Lauren Book got that two-thirds vote, so it's eligible today. There's a long list of bills on third reading in the Senate who goes in around 1 o'clock today. So it'd be hard to predict definitely where it's going to go, but the fact that they got two-thirds to pull it out of committee would suggest to me that this bill may be primed and ready to pass.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn now to the big issue over the last few weeks, and that is school safety and gun legislation. Chris Carmody, does raising the age to buy guns, a three-day waiting period for sales, banning bump stocks and other things, does that kind of equal compromise on gun legislation for Republicans? And how significant is it for the Republicans in Florida?
Well, considering since the Republicans have taken charge of the legislature in the mid-1990s, there hasn't been a single infringement on gun rights. I would say that's definitely a compromise, perhaps even a concession. There's no secret that this Republican legislature has been very supportive of the Second Amendment and loyal to many of the NRA priorities. However, as we've all seen in the last couple of weeks, the momentum, the pressure, the advocacy by these students from Parkland and their parents was overwhelming. And while the bill certainly looked at moments it might die, especially in the House with the where some of the Republicans who weren't going to support it and the Democrats who looked like they were going to take a caucus position, obviously they got to where they needed to get and got it passed. But yet, this is a major compromise. There's no doubt about that.
What about the NRA, though? Because they're not happy with some things like, you know, raising the minimum age for purchase of certain firearms, for example. What are you hearing from them and their lobbyists about this bill?
Well, I haven't had any direct conversations with them, but I am aware that they've done plenty of voter alerts in talking to members who voted against the bill in support, if you will, of the NRA. The NRA worked it hard. They did not want to see some of these things pass. And again, I'll defend them for a moment on this, even as difficult as that may be. This is their position. They believe strongly in the Second Amendment, and they don't believe there should be any infringements on the right to own and bear arms. And raising the age, they would view that as such. And even the waiting period gave them some heartburn. So the bigger question for them is going to be how they move from here. I fully expect the governor will sign this bill. And so now what? How politically active do they get? Do they try to primary some Republicans who voted against them? Do they aggressively go after certain Democrats that spoke out largely on this? I don't know. Some of that will be a question of resources. Some of that will be a question of what will be the backlash on them if they do that.
Mm-hmm. So Dick Batchelor, as Chris says, of course the bill is now in the governor's hands. Some controversial elements to it, though, the idea of training and arming some mm-hmm. school staff. Mm-hmm. Do you see the governor signing off on that?
I think he's going to sign the bill. Now, there are League of Women Voters and other gun safety advocates have basically asking the governor to veto the funding for that as it regards arming teachers in the classroom. I go back on a point that Chris made, I agree with. I think the Republican legislature over the last few years has really prided themselves on passing NRA-supported gun rights legislation, including the Stand Your Ground, so they have this kind of position. But the perfect storm happened. The shooting, which is awful, and the death of 17 people is awful, had it happened after the legislative session and you had a 10-month lapse for people to move on to other issues, this would not have happened. I was in the Capitol when those students showed up there. Those students have kept the pressure on. While there are elements in this bill that the governor himself does not like, the NRA does not like, the governor cannot pass this. Keep in mind, in the political perspective, he's a candidate for U.S. Senate running against the senior Senator Bill Nelson. Mm-hmm. So politically, he's in a position now that he really has to sign this piece of legislation. And whether or not he will even address it. He did oppose, by the way, arming teachers.
Right. So, and he could go with his pen and sort of...
He could veto the money out of the budget for that part of the program.
Mm-hmm. I want to get a call in here. We've got Roy calling in from Rockledge. Roy, listening to this conversation, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
I listened briefly to the last comment on it. My comment is, if people really want gun control, gun restrictions that the legislature is unwilling to make. In Florida, we have a constitutional amendment petitioning process.
Mm-hmm.
There is 2 years between now and 2020, the first time that it could be on the ballot. We've passed the deadline this year. If people wanted more effective gun controls, they could put together a finely crafted constitutional amendment proposition and get it on the ballot by then.
You see that as being a better way or a more likely way to get something through than having lawmakers come up with something themselves?
I can only say look at the record.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Roy, thanks for your comment. I do appreciate that. I want to throw that to you, Chris. What about that notion? I mean, has that been an option or an avenue in the past for advocates of gun legislation reform? Have they gone the constitutional amendment route?
The last time I've seen sort of a grassroots effort like that, I would go to the Fair Districts Initiative that was successful. It's expensive. Right. Just ask John Morgan. Took him 2 tries to get medical marijuana. And that was not cheap. And so if the George Soros's of the world that like to swoop, you know, kind of descend into Florida and drop money off for candidates and issues, give money to that, sure. Polling would suggest that an issue like that, depending on how aggressive the restrictions would be, would pass.
Mm-hmm.
However, there'll be money on the other side, of course, and it would be a very strong campaign. And what I think, time has proven that this issue, the Second Amendment for the people who believe in it, it will drive them to the ballot box every single time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to defend it.
So
it'll be expensive and it'll be tough.
Dick.
Let me agree with Chris. It's extraordinarily expensive. I think John Morgan spent $10 million trying to get his issue on the ballot twice. So it's very expensive dealing about number one and expect, and I agree with Chris on this, extraordinary opposition from the NRA. Keep in mind the NRA takes pride in not giving campaign contributions, but their power is in membership and direct mail and persuasive pieces. Keep in mind that they spent about in third-party expenditures over $30 million in support of Trump. So they have an incredible machine to where they can do direct calls, put the pressure on, so they would be very, very much opposed and would be prepared to spend any amount of money to kill to anything like this.
We're talking about the final days of the Florida legislative session, gun reform and other issues. You can weigh in as well with your questions and comments, 1-866-338-5252. We're over on Twitter too, at WMFE Orlando. Well, there's other aspects of this bill too, a boost for mental health services. Dick Batchelor, does it go far enough on the mental health front?
Well, first of all, understand that Florida is 49 out of 50 states as far as the level, the very low level of funding for mental health issues. And this package does include money for mental health services within the school system. But I think the legislature certainly has an obligation, too, to provide mental health funding for the community-based mental health services. So I applaud the new monies because it's very, very important because, again, we are so woefully underfunded when it comes to mental health services in Florida.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, right now we were talking to 90.7's Brendan Byrne, who's been covering the trial of Noor Selman, the widow of the Pulse gunman, and there are parallels, aren't there, not between Parkland and Pulse. And one thing that's been pointed out by the likes of Carlos Guillermo Smith, a Democrat from Orlando, there's a different response this time around to this shooting compared to what happened in Orlando a couple of years ago. Why are we seeing legislative action now when none was taken a couple of years ago?
Timing. The legislature is in session now, and the students are up there making an impression and lobbying, and the parents of those who lost children were there, and they happen to be in session. Were there a lapse of 10 months or so? I don't think the legislature would have addressed this issue as strongly as they have in opposition from the NRA.
Mm-hmm. Well, the I guess there's some kind of budget Tetris that's going on here too, because the school safety bill is quite expensive. They've had to take some money out of other areas. But one thing that this bill does is the budget does rather the agreement the lawmakers have come to is it puts money. The education bill puts money into Bright Futures, puts pressure on teachers' unions, increases spending for K-12 students. There's also language about free speech on college campuses. Dick Batchelor, staying with you for a moment, what are you hearing from unions and other sectors about the education bill and its requirements that unions maintain 50% dues-paying membership? What are you hearing about that?
It's an assault on the unions, public unions. They're trying to weaken them, obviously, and they're basically the bill, as you indicated, would require that you have a 50% membership of those you represent. Otherwise, you basically get decertified unless you can get there. And also keep in mind, too, on a broader scope, this legislature under the Republican leadership has really put a tremendous billions of dollars, new money that can be used for private schools and charter schools and take money out of the public sector. And they only increased, by the way, the per student funding by like $100 for public education. So, frankly, it's an assault on public education and going after the teachers' unions, in my opinion.
Chris Batchelor.
Just ruined his reputation forever.
I apologize, Chris Carmody. What does this mean for unions in general in Florida? Dick is saying that it's an assault on unions. I mean, it's not a very friendly state for unions anyway. Is this kind of eroding their foothold in Florida further, per Dick Batchelor's point, or do you see this as not such a bad move if you're a union?
It's a shot across the bow, but I've talked to some of the folks at FEA that will be impacted by this. There's very few chapters that this actually affects today, and if anything, it motivates them to go recruit new members. Mm-hmm. So in a weird way, it might actually help them bolster their ranks. There's a lot of reasons to join a teachers union. My brother is a high school teacher here in Orange County, and I talk to him about these issues all the time. There's a lot of benefits that come from that membership, not just having some political advocacy. So if anything, it's just going to motivate them to go recruit folks. I think that the better parts of what you were talking about is the bright futures. This is a huge step. If we all recall during the recession, they reduced the 100% and 75% scholarships for bright futures. And that hurt. That hurt parents. That hurt students that were going into the universities. So funding that at the full level again, where if you get 100% scholarship, you actually will go to school in the state of Florida for free, that's a major deal, and we'll offload some of that student debt that these students are racking up and allow them to pursue the careers they want. Go ahead.
Chris Carmody, do you think we're in election year, right, midterm elections? Is that sort of maybe the reason for or the rationale behind some of what we're seeing as part of this bill, the education bill, and other pieces of legislation that haven't really got a look in previous years, and now we're seeing some money allocated for those things?
Perhaps, but I will say this. President Negron in the Senate, he did his tour of the state universities before he was elected president. That was the last election cycle. And he came out of it right in that November timeframe, said his priority was going to be increasing higher education funding, including fully funding Bright Futures. And he did it last session, but it got wrapped up in the college system reform and the state colleges. And the governor vetoed that. So the funding was there, but it wasn't in policy. Now, assuming the governor signs it, it'll be the policy of the state that you fully fund those. So I'll say, I think President Negron and his colleagues in the House, obviously, that went along with this, sure, there's always election issues on that, but I think they genuinely wanted to fully fund these scholarships for these students.
Mm-hmm. Back to K through 12, Dick Batchelor, the so-called bullying vouchers, mm-hmm. offering students who are bullied the opportunity to take a voucher and move to a different school if they so choose. A lot of pushback to that from unions, from teachers. What does that sort of tell you about this legislature's approach to education, that specific part of the bill?
Well, the Speaker of the House, Corcoran, obviously has this very controversial omnibus bill dealing with education. That's one element of it, that you would be able to take private money, scholarship money, and go to another school if you're being bullied. It really is a way to incent the use of those kind of dollars and take it out of the public school system. The question I always ask, so what do you do with the bully?
Right.
So do you, every time that the bully bullies somebody, do you transfer somebody out of the school? You haven't addressed the issue. The issue is the bully, not the person being bullied.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to move on to health care. The House and Senate were at odds over how to reimburse hospitals for Medicaid. That sort of put a little bump in the road for negotiations earlier in the week before they came to an agreement. The Senate's plan would have helped hospitals like the Hospital Corporation of America and take money away from nonprofits like Jackson Memorial in Miami, I believe some of the nonprofits here in Orlando too. But eventually they went with the House plan, which kind of keeps the current funding model. But nonetheless, the cost of health care keeps increasing. Chris Carmody, do you see this issue cropping up again in the future, the idea of how to fund healthcare in Florida, how to reimburse hospitals for those expenses?
Absolutely. There's just too much money in the system and too much at stake for all these hospitals, not just the safety net hospitals that you were referring to, but also HCA, a for-profit hospital. They stepped up their lobbying game this session, and they convinced the Senate to create a plan that spread the money out a little more across all the hospitals, including for-profits. But in the end, the House, no surprise, Jackson Memorial, which is in the House Appropriations Chairman's backyard, that became a priority, and they won the day on that particular issue. But absolutely, there's just too much money involved in this and too much at stake for these hospital systems to not continue to go to Tallahassee and either ask them to preserve the way it is now if you're a safety net hospital, or if you're a for-profit or not one of the safety net hospitals but nonprofits, to say, hey, we want some of the money as well. So I don't see this going away anytime.
Dick Batchelor, does this kind of tie back to the issues that Florida has had with the Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, rather? I mean, can you form that link there?
Well, you can link it back to Florida's failure to expand their Medicaid program when given the option by the federal government, which would be 90% funded by the federal government, 10% by the state. If we had expanded the Medicaid, it would cover about 900,000 more people in Florida, most of whom are children. So to Chris's point, it's always going to be a hot issue because the ever-increasing cost of health care coverage. And then you have what they call the LIP program, the low-income pool program, which is where you use the Medicaid monies to match the drawdown federal dollars for that. So that's controversial, and I'm glad they finally took the for-profit hospitals out of the mix and protected the not-for-profit hospitals who provide so much uncompensated care. So, yes, it's always going to be a tough issue. It's very very expensive. Medicaid makes a substantial part of the state budget, so it will always be a frontline issue.
Mm-hmm. Final thing I want to talk about is the environment. Now, $77 million for Florida Forever, the program to buy lands and set them aside for conservation. Chris Carmody, this is a pretty fiscally conservative legislature. Was it a surprise to see that program getting this kind of money this time around?
No, but it comes down to some of the personal politics. I mean, Amendment 1, which passed a couple years ago, requires money be spent in such ways like this. There's other ways to spend it. But the Senate Appropriations Chairman, Rob Bradley, who's from Northeast Florida, this was a priority from day one. And to his credit, he kept pushing and kept pushing. And you hear Adam Putnam say it and others say it, you know, you can't, what makes Florida is not always some of the things we see on the commercials, but it's our wonderful environment. And the minute we stop making Florida Florida, we're going to start losing that. So that was an absolute priority of Rob Bradley's, and to his credit, he saw it to the end. It was a negotiating issue with the House. It was clearly his priority, and the House negotiated with him on other things, but he pushed for it and got it through.
Dick Batchelor, is this budget, do you think, a sign that that program might head back to the kind of funding levels it enjoyed in the late 90s and early 2000s?
Well, the real question is, when the budget is finally adopted, to be able to see how much of the Amendment 1 monies are spent directly on environmental preservation, land conservation. While this number seems to be attractive, I want to see how much money was in the Amendment 1 fund and how much is being spent directly for environmental protection and land acquisition. So I don't know the answer to that yet, but we'll see.
Finally, real quickly, Chris Carmody, last year Governor Scott vetoed quite a lot of money out of the budget, some $400 million or so. Do you see him wielding a veto pen like that this time around?
No, it's election season, and while he's not announced anything, most folks believe he will be a U.S. Senate candidate. And if you just look, every election year, he has his veto. He's vetoed less in election years, and whether he's been on the ballot or not, because that's how it goes. It's hard for folks to get reelected if they bring nothing home. So I think he's going to be in a good mood, and I don't think we're going to see too many vetoes, not like last year.
Dick, what are your thoughts?
In politics, there's a time to rise above principle. It usually involves a decision to run for higher office. So I agree. I don't think it would veto anything.
Rise above principle. That sounds a little bit cynical. But nonetheless, Dick Batchelor, an expert in the field of politics, thank you so much for joining us. And Chris Carmody, I want to thank you as well. Chris Carmody, shareholder with Gray Robinson and Republican political analyst, and Dick Batchelor, founder of the Dick Batchelor Management Group, a former Democratic state lawmaker and political analyst for the Democrats, the Democrats as well. Thank you both.
Thank you.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty.
These are turbulent times for SeaWorld. SeaWorld Entertainment CEO Joel Manby announced a couple of weeks ago he would step down. Manby was brought on 3 years ago as the theme park company weathered a storm of controversy after the release of the movie Blackfish, a documentary about the death of trainer Dawn Brancheau. And Manby's departure also came as SeaWorld posted fourth quarter loss of $20.4 million. Well, joining me now is Seth Kaberski. He's the arts and culture columnist for Orlando Weekly. He's also written a number of theme park guides, including co-authoring Beyond Disney, The Unofficial Guide to SeaWorld, Universal Orlando, and The Best of Central Florida. Seth, welcome back to Intersection.
Thanks for having me again.
So SeaWorld has basically been fighting against these bad headlines ever since the Blackfish documentary came out about 5 years ago. Has there been any good news for SeaWorld in that time?
There's really not been a lot of good news, especially in the headlines. You know, the whole Orlando theme park universe went through a seismic shift back in 2010 when The Wizarding World of Harry Potter opened at Universal. Up until then, SeaWorld and Universal were kind of running neck and neck in second place behind Disney.
So Universal was able to kind of jump up a rung by doing that, wasn't it?
It definitely launched Universal up to another level, putting it really shoulder to shoulder with Disney, whereas SeaWorld didn't put in the kind of capital investment or purchase the kind of intellectual property that it needed to keep pace with Disney and Universal, even putting aside controversies about things like Blackfish.
So when you talk about intellectual property, you're talking about like a movie they could build a ride around, for example.
Yeah, back in the day, Shamu itself was the intellectual property. People would come to a park for the animals themselves alone. But now the theme park business, much like the movie business, is based around tentpole properties, intellectual properties like the Marvel characters, the Harry Potter characters. And unless you have some kind of hook that's got that kind of global marketing behind it, it's really hard to bring people in, especially when Disney and Universal are both monopolizing multiple days of a person's vacation. And SeaWorld really only has 1 day worth of activity.
Because the approach from the likes of Disney is to keep people on park property. And let's face it, they have a lot of property to keep people on, right?
Absolutely. That's why you've seen Disney not investing quite so much in their theme parks in the recent years, though we're going to have Toy Story Land and Star Wars Land opening up in the next year or so. But you see Disney putting their effort into things like Disney Springs, more dining, more shopping, more things to keep people on property after the parks are done for the day. And Universal has copied that model and improved on it in some ways with more hotels, more dining at their City Walk, both really fighting to keep their guests from drifting off to International Drive, to SeaWorld, to those other secondary attractions that used to make up a huge portion of the market back in the 80s and early 90s.
Well, what about over the Christmas break when SeaWorld has a bunch of performers come in and have they have concerts, they have, you know, ice displays, et cetera. Does that help offset some of that?
You know, it does. Universal was the first theme park in town to learn how important seasonal events and festivals were. Halloween kind of kicked off the whole seasonal craze here in town. And Disney has followed up on that over the years with things like their Food and Wine Festival and their Flower and Garden Festival. SeaWorld has been kind of late to that seasonal festival party, but they've done a fantastic job of keeping up. The one area in which I would say SeaWorld can really compete with the other big parks is with those events like Christmas. They did a fantastic job this past Christmas. Unfortunately, this last year was the last year that they have the license to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and other memorable characters. And if they want to continue with SeaWorld, they're going to have to come up with all new characters because those rights are reverting back to Universal. But you know, right now SeaWorld has a food festival going on that is in my opinion, a better value than the food festivals that Epcot does. They also do a great job of appealing to the Latino community. They have food and music festivals that appeal to that segment much stronger than Disney and Universal's offerings.
Disney and Universal, they just hike their prices. Meanwhile, you have some theme park industry experts saying SeaWorld should have to go or may have to go the other way and actually lower prices to get more customers through the turnstiles. What's it like at SeaWorld these days? I mean, what, is it a crowded experience? Does it take a long time to get on one of the popular rides there?
The answer to your question is no, but still yes. If you are not a fan of big crowds, SeaWorld's a great place to visit. I was there just after New Year's, took my family there for the first time in a year or so, and we really did have a lovely time because the park is still beautiful and well-maintained. The employees are still very friendly. The animal exhibits are still, you know, very well done, but it just feels a little hollowed out. And the biggest sign of that is that the rides, the big roller coasters, just don't operate the way they should. Rides that they could put 2,000 people an hour through, they're sometimes lucky to get 1,000 or 1,200 people an hour.
And is that because people just aren't lining up, or are they having technical problems?
No, there's still lines. You can still wait a half hour, an hour for some of the attractions, mostly because they have cut staffing and operations, you know, to save on maintenance and other costs, cut to the bone. You know, an attraction like the Antarctica Penguin attraction, which was supposed to be a big groundbreaking technological advancement for SeaWorld, doesn't pull long lines of people, but those lines move very, very slowly.
And that probably doesn't make for a great experience.
No, it can be very frustrating, especially when people see that they're charging extra for an express pass when there's only 100 people in line ahead of you, but it still takes 20 minutes or half an hour to get onto a ride. That can be very frustrating. However, the operations of their live shows are still very well done. They can pack a huge number of people into one of those stadiums. So if you are the kind of person who likes to see live shows and walk around and look at things as opposed to actually ride a ride, then SeaWorld is the place for you.
And that kind of leads into my next question, because since its inception, SeaWorld has been associated with marine mammal life like the orcas. I mean, you mentioned Shamu as the intellectual property that was the crown jewel of SeaWorld for a long time. And then, of course, that changed in the last 5 years. There's been the decision to end captive breeding, changed the way some of those shows are presented. I mean, what do customers go to SeaWorld for? Are they going because they can get up close to some of those marine mammals?
Yeah, that is definitely still an appeal. That is definitely still draw the place. The audience that comes to SeaWorld is kind of split. On the one hand, now that Universal has torn down their Dueling Dragons roller coaster, SeaWorld is kind of the undisputed roller coaster capital of Orlando. If you are into those big thrill-seeking rides, the Kraken, the Mako, the Manta, SeaWorld is your stop. However, that's got kind of a narrow niche appeal. Not everyone is willing to go on one of these super intense roller coasters. So you've got kind of a split between the teenagers, the older kids who are there for the giant roller coasters, and then the rest of the family who has to wait for them by the stingray tank or, you know, walking through one of the aquariums while the other half of the family is riding the rides.
So from the fans' perspective, from the theme park goers' perspective, what does SeaWorld feel like? Does it feel like two separate parks? Does it feel like an aquarium with some rides or a ride-based park with some animals as well?
You know, they don't call themselves a theme park because theme is really the one thing that's missing if you compare to Disney and Universal. Yes, there are fantastic shows at SeaWorld, and yes, there are a few good rides. But what it lacks is the overall sense of immersion in a different place. You're always kind of aware that you're in a park that was built in the 70s and still has kind of a strange, dated vibe to it. Whereas Disney and Universal are creating these lands that totally surround you and put you into a different environment. SeaWorld always kind of reminds you that you're at a park.
So Joel Manby has left the scene. Seth Kaburski, if you were CEO of SeaWorld, what would you do with the park?
If I was CEO with SeaWorld, I would keep my resume updated and polished. They're in a really tough position. They have to decide whether SeaWorld is going to try to compete on the same level as Disney and Universal, in which case they need huge capital investments. They need the kind of money to come in that I don't see that they have right now. And they probably could only raise by selling off major assets such as Busch Gardens, which I think Busch Gardens is probably more attractive to an investor right now than the SeaWorld brand because it doesn't have the same taint on it. If you're not going to go head-to-head with Disney and Universal, then you've got to accept your status as a second-tier regional park, and your competition is now more something like FunSpot, and you've got to radically rethink your pricing and what kind of attractions you're going to bring in. My biggest worry is that if revenues goes down, if park profits go lower and lower, that the next place they'll want to cut is the support for the animals and the kind of charitable nonprofit work, which is really important that they do for rescuing marine animals. I can see that's partially out of the goodness of their heart, partially as PR. If the money isn't coming in the turnstiles and the budget's got to go somewhere, I would be sad to see if that's where it gets cut from.
Well, Seth Kaberski is the arts and culture columnist for the Orlando Weekly. He's also written a bunch of theme park guides, including co-authoring Beyond Disney, The Unofficial Guide to SeaWorld, Universal Orlando, and The Best of Central Florida. Seth, thank you so much for coming in.
Anytime. My pleasure.
Still to come.
An experience like this is what it takes. It's a life-changing experience. And these students, I'm sure, and myself, will never be the same.
Musicians from Jones High School prepare to play at Carnegie Hall. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. 42 students from the Jones High School Wind Ensemble and 45 from the Concert Choir are bound for Carnegie Hall for a performance next month. A fundraising campaign for the trip caught the eye of Ellen DeGeneres, and last month the band director and choir director appeared on her show Ellen. This weekend the groups will hold a concert, the last one before their Carnegie Hall performance. Well, Jamal Nicholas, band director at Jones High School, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, sir, for being here.
How big a deal is this Carnegie Hall concert?
Oh, man, it's huge. It's a life-changing experience for myself and for my students, and we're really excited about the opportunity.
Have you performed there yourself when you were a student?
No, I never had the opportunity. I have been once to view a concert put on by my alma mater, Florida A&M University, but I have not myself performed the stage there at Carnegie Hall.
So how did this opportunity come about?
Well, sometime in spring 2017, we received an email, myself and Mrs. Andrea Green, the choir director, encouraging us to apply. And I'm not sure how they had heard about our programs, but they sent a glowing email saying, you know, how impressed they were with what they had heard and encouraged us to apply for this opportunity. And so we did. And then in the summer of 2017, we received confirmation that we had been accepted to the respective festivals, the Choral Festival, the National Music Festival, and the Instrumental Festival for myself. Mm-hmm. And so we began preparations from there.
So who else is going to be there? Is it a bunch of high school musicians from around the country that are going to be performing?
Yes. I forget the number of ensembles exactly, but I know there are there were nine high school ensembles selected, and of those nine, only three had their band and choir to be selected at the same time. This is huge.
What are you telling your students then? What can they expect? Because, you know, Carnegie Hall, it's got this history behind it. What are you telling your students to expect when they walk out onto that stage and start playing?
Well, first of all, expect to be to have your breath taken away by the magnificent sight of what is actually quite a beautiful hall in itself. Not to speak of the history of those that have performed, but just the hall itself is magnificent. And we are preparing to be overwhelmed with the beauty of it. And then to speak about the history of Carnegie Hall, it's really important for us to remember that everyone who is anybody has performed this stage, you know. And so it's a big deal for us to have this opportunity to perform this stage.
When you coach the kids in the band and the wind ensemble, You spend a bit of time sort of talking to them about your musical heroes, and some of those folks I'm sure would have performed at Carnegie Hall themselves.
Oh, sure, sure. Everyone from the New York Philharmonic as an ensemble all the way back to Louis Armstrong, who's one of my personal favorite musicians. Again, as I said, everybody who is anybody has played this stage, and it's almost a rite of passage for anyone who is serious about music.
And the audience is going to be quite big too, I imagine, being a festival and a lot of interest in the performers there up on stage as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're looking for a packed auditorium and to have some supporters from Orlando as well to be there with us.
You all had to raise quite a bit of money to get
yes.
these kids up
yeah.
there.
It costed $200,000 just to secure the airline tickets and the lodging in New York.
Mm-hmm.
We still have some other things to take care of, but that guarantees our ability to travel and stay in New York. But there are some other incidentals to take care of, to include the rental of tuxedos for our male students, because the wind ensemble grew this year and we don't have enough tuxedos in the inventory, you know, so we have to get something for everybody to wear that is professional. We also have to ship instruments up, which is an additional cost, as you know. We have to ship them as cargo or as luggage. We're still working through the details, but there are still some intangibles to work through. In addition to the meals that we're going to eat while we're there, we want to make sure that the students are fed throughout and that they don't have to worry about anything while they're on the trip.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep tabs on all of that? Because you're not just thinking about the music. You've got to think about all the logistics as well. It's almost like a military operation you've got going here.
Yeah, with tons and tons of support from our parents, from our community, from our alumni, from our administration here at the school. We get it done through the support of those who believe in what we do.
Mm-hmm. And Jamal Nicholas, you had an appearance on the Ellen DeGeneres show fairly recently. Talk
yes.
me through what happened there.
Okay, well, they reached out to us and told us that we'd be flying out to record a segment for Ellen's YouTube show, her online show. And when we got there, we're sitting in the dressing room, and producer comes in about 15 minutes before the show is to start and says, sorry, we've been lying to you guys. You're actually going to be on the show, and you're going to get to meet Ellen. So we're flipping out, naturally, because this is a surprise to us. So we go out, and we meet Ellen, and we're sitting on stage. And then Ellen asks, what do you think your kids are doing right now? And I said, well, I think they're probably at home, because it was 6 o'clock here on the East Coast. And I was there, so I was sure we weren't in rehearsal. And she said no, and she pointed at the monitor, and there all our kids were assembled here on campus. Ellen had sent a crew here to Orlando to be on this side with our kids. And then we got this huge contribution from Ellen herself and the Walmart Corporation for $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
It was absolutely amazing. And we are so very blessed to have the support of Ellen DeGeneres and Walmart.
And being on the show, I'm sure, brought a lot more attention and focus on the band and the choir, too. Have you had a lot of media inquiries since that appearance?
Not quite so many media inquiries, but lots of friends and supporters who maybe weren't aware of what we were doing, they are aware of it now, mm-hmm. because so many millions of people were able to see what we have going on here, and it's really a blessing to have that kind of support.
Just back to the trip up to New York. So how many of the kids in the wind ensemble and in the choir, for that matter, would have made a trip like this anywhere, you know, whether it's in the United States or out of the country? Like, is this the first time getting on a plane for some of them?
Yes, it is. We travel a fair bit between the band and the choir. You may remember we did the National Memorial Day Parade a couple years ago in Washington, D.C., so we do travel a fair bit, but traveling by plane for some of our students is a brand new experience, so we're excited about that.
Mm-hmm. What are they saying? Like, what's kind of their mood been throughout this whole experience of learning that you'd been accepted and then fundraising and then getting prepared and with the music, too, as well, making sure that's sort of polished and as good as it's going to be?
I think they are equal parts stressed, excited, frustrated, annoyed with Mr. Nicholas because I drive them really hard, and thankful for the overwhelming support we've received. It's just a big motley crew of, you know, emotions. And so especially for those who haven't traveled this way before, they're really excited because they're going to get to check off a couple of their bucket list items mm-hmm. here all at once. They're going to fly on a plane. They're going to New York, which for some people is new. They're going to play Carnegie Hall, which is new for all of us. And so it's just a huge trip packed with so much experience for our students and for ourselves. I told them recently, this is the most significant concert I've ever conducted, and I'm sure in their young musical lives it's the most significant one they've ever played. So it's a huge trip
mm-hmm.
from all the angles.
Who do you think is going to be more nervous, you or them, when you raise that baton and play the first notes?
That is tough. That's tough. I think we're all in it together. And once we give the downbeat, we'll find out, you know. But we will be prepared. But I will say there's a fair bit of anxiety about it because of the gravity of the performance. And I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say I'm more nervous than the students are. Mm-hmm. You know, they play all the time, but they are able to connect with their instrument. They're able to touch something. My back is turned to the audience, so I'm not able to see how it's going because my back is turned. Mm-hmm. I think I'm more nervous than they are.
You'll hear that audience, though, right? I mean, how many supporters have you got going up there, do you think?
I would estimate anywhere between 75 and 100. Mm-hmm. And people are still making arrangements to be there. People who you know, maybe weren't available per se, but are making arrangements to be there because it's such a historic event. They are making it happen so that they can be there to support us.
How important, Jamal Nicholas, is music in the lives of these students? Is this something that they are going to take on as a career once they get out of high school, or is it just part of their experience at the school?
Sure. There's a variety of engagement levels here. We have some students who do it, you know, primarily as a hobby. Some of them do it to discover new ways to earn scholarship money. You know, some of it, it's purely business for them. But a great deal of them, and I would estimate all of them, have some emotional connection with the music. You know, from a very young age, we're connected to music, whether we are consuming it, creating it, you know, sharing it. And so for all of them, they are going to be able to use their passion for music to perform this very important concert. And I think, or I'm hoping rather, that this experience will move all of them from just consumers of music to wanting to be lifelong creators and sharers, even educators of music. But an experience like this is what it takes. It's a life-changing experience. And these students, I'm sure, and myself, will never be the same.
And for you to have this choir and this band is sort of like the public face of the school, because they're like the ambassadors for the school, right? Do you feel a lot of pressure on your shoulders?
Yes, there's tremendous pressure on us, but we've been doing it for a while, and myself and Mrs. Green, the choir director, are both graduates of Jones High School. Myself, the class of 2009, and Mrs. Green, the class of 1988. And so we are very well aware of the tradition of both the instrumental and choral programs here. And we are just blessed and humbled to be able to carry on those traditions.
It's more than just a job for you, obviously. This is pretty important for you.
This is a calling, a passion to be back at home. Mm-hmm.
And just finally, Jamal Nicholas, there is a fundraiser concert. Tell me what we can expect from that.
The concert is actually on this Sunday, March 11th, at St. Luke's Episcopal, which is, I forget the address, but it's somewhere off of Popka Vineland there in Windermere. That concert is at 4 p.m. We'd love to have everybody support, everybody who's listening, there to support us this Sunday, March 11th at St. Luke's Episcopal.
And are you playing the same material you're going to be playing at Carnegie Hall?
It won't be the full program. It'll be condensed. But all three selections we're performing this Sunday will be performed in New York. We are performing On the Mall, which is a march by Edwin Franco Goldman, Sunscapes by a good friend of mine, Chandler Wilson, as well as the Nathan Hill Trilogy by composer James Curnow.
Jamal Nicholas is the band director at Jones High School. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
And later this afternoon on Spotlight, tune in for an interview with the Jones High School Choir Director, Andrea Green. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Technical direction from Nicole Darden-Creston. You can find us online, wmfe.org/intersection. We're on the NPR One app, and you can download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.